Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Good morning and welcome to another week and welcome to another edition of Spin the Rally Pod, and another edition without the glorious tones of Lisa O'Sullivan, still stuck in Beijing. Probably not stuck in Beijing, actually loving life in Beijing.
She's having a great time, David.
Yeah,
she's having an amazing time.
She is, and I have to say it was very encouraging that the Winter Olympics got some snow over the weekend. That was was quite a treat, wasn't it? Some real snow, yeah,
canceled,
should we say.
Cancelled events, it's lovely.
Yeah, and am I right in thinking we have a big medal hope coming on Wednesday? Now, I knew I should have done some research before I jumped into this. Dave,
is this curling, is it?
No. I was going to say something dreadful about curling, but I won't. Dave, is it either a slalom or a super giant slalom or a giant slalom? Somebody help me out here. Dave,
I thought they'd all been actually already. The giant slalom's been
Dave
already,
Riding.
Yeah.
I thought is he not coming? Dave the Rocket.
Jolly good. I've not followed it, but good luck to the guy.
Luke is remaining absolutely silent. Is that because you know you don't know anything about this, Luke?
It's because I don't know anything about this, and I have to say, just to pull a bit of a sort of rug over the behind the scenes stuff, we've got a plan. We always have a plan. Last week was my first time on the podcast. I saw the plan firsthand. Nothing about curling this year. This is the wonderful thing about podcasting. You just have a chat and it goes wherever the wind blows. But no, I haven't got a clue, I'm afraid, about curling. Only rallying.
Right.
And even then it's questionable.
Well, apologies for that, and apologies for a lack of an introduction as well. Obviously, we've already heard George Donaldson, our former sporting director and man who knows everything about WRC, and Luke Berry, our deputy editor from dirtfish.com. Welcome both, and let's get back to the podcast running order, which means, Luke, over to you to tell us what was big on the site last week.
Yeah, so I don't know about you chats, but for me, it almost feels a little bit strange, this sort of four-week gap between Monte Carlo and Sweden. It is, I don't want to say it's a long wait, because I think we're lucky as WRC sort of fans and journalists and former team members and whatever you'd like to call us, is we get rallying a lot. We don't have a massive big sort of three-month break, but it does. For me, it's felt quite long. We've had Monte, I just want to get going. And I don't know if the readers and listeners all feel the same, but in terms of stories, we're still kind of a little bit in a weird hangover, aren't we, of looking back on the first round, but also trying to look ahead to the next one, which is getting closer. But big story, I guess, David, and of course it was you that broke it, was Jordan Cerdoides has become the first privateer driver to own a Rally One car, which is exciting.
It is, just to go back to that point, and you're dead right, Luke, and it's funny when, you know, the first round is Monte. You know, Monte's such a big event that you kind of can't help. It sort of sets the tone, it sets the benchmark for the season, so you're always going back to it, and then Sweden. But then after Sweden, it's going to be even worse, because we've got a massive, like, isn't it 8-week gap or something to Croatia? But fortunately, we do have Rally of Nations Guanajuato in the middle of that, which we'll get to later. Jordan Cerdoides, great news. For me, great news for the championship that we're allowed sell these cars and buy these cars.
And what a lovely guy Jordan is. He's an absolute 100% rally man, a rally fan, loves driving, doesn't ever think he's going to win a rally, doesn't pretend it. He just enjoys the experience of driving a rally car and competing on an event. And, you know, at the end of every stage, he's got a smile on his face. He just loves it.
It's great
to see him buying that car.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's a great shot in the arm for me for the championship. I could kind of see where the FIA wanted to go at the start of 17 with trying to keep these cars really exclusive, make them the sort of Formula One of the forest and stuff like that. But ours is a very different sport to Formula One and to circuit racing. And, you know, we always have been very, very inclusive, haven't we, George? We will get to some incredible stories later in the pod about you going and taking on the world's best six times in Sweden. It's what we're about. So it's a great move, great to see. And I'm sure there'll be plenty more of those cars sold very soon. But Jordan did make the point that he'd already lodged his order for the car before Sebastian Loeb won Monte Carlo. So I'm sure perhaps the price might have gone up a little bit when he won the Monte. But we talk about people getting out of cars with a big smile on their face. The one guy who didn't get out of his car in Monte with a big smile on his face was Adrian Formo. Because I think it wasn't terribly difficult to get out of the car, because I'm not sure where the door was once he'd finished rolling. It was quite a long way away. But he did get out, and he did go back to M Sport, which is another story we've covered this week, Luke. Formo going up to M Sport to work on his car for Sweden.
It's fantastic, isn't it? And it sounds weird to say that, in a sense. I don't think anybody, Formo, certainly not M Sport management, Malcolm Wilson, Rich Millen, and all the mechanics, would have chosen this. But it is quite a sort of, it is a nice story, I think, to see him come back. And he had sort of, it had been rumoured that he'd come back and do it. And I think he was meant to originally come a week before he did, and then he turned up. But there's a whole week he spent there working with the mechanics. And he said to you, David, about how it sort of helped him with the team spirit side of things. It's an interesting one for a driver, this, isn't it? Because you always get on your mechanics. Of course you do. You have to. But to spend that much time with him, and not only that, but could it even help him learn about the car he's driving? You get a proper hands-on look at the Puma.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing of all, Luke, is the fact that it'll help him understand the car, because, you know, occasionally you have to repair a rally car. When you intimately understand what it is you're undoing and what you have to do to get to a part to repair it, it's immeasurable. It makes it the impossible possible. So yeah, the huge value in doing it, but also the humility in going back and doing something like that tells you a lot about the guy. You know, I've not really talked to Adrian much, just a couple of times in Safari last year, and just as an interview, not socially at all, not even a chat. Nice guy, but just seeing that article fills me with warmth for the guy. I think, yeah, what a super bloke. He's gone up there and, you know, worked with the blokes, you know, sat and had a coffee with the blokes and just got on with it. It's great.
Would you have ever had anybody like that, George, when you were working with teams, that you would have encouraged them? Because, you know, the thing that Rich Milner said was that it is difficult if you've had quite a big crash as a driver and then you don't see any of the team until the pre-event or even the actual event in Sweden, and then you've got to sort of walk into the team. And
well, if you go back to the older times, it can give you two examples. One is, well, on the old recce's, when we used to be down in Monte Carlo for 3 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks before the event, recce-ing, you'd be alternating in and out. You'd go to a couple of tests on the way, so you'd be recce-ing for a week, and then there'd be a test team would be down, and you would go and maybe do 2 days testing, and we would sit with that. The drivers were with you all the time. So, you know, it was just before of you. There were two mechanics and a driver and co-driver. So you were socialising with them all the time. So it was, you know, there was a lot more interfacing together because you were away that length of period. You became very good friends or very valued colleagues. Or if you didn't get on with the driver, it would have been quite a strain. And a mechanic that didn't get on with the driver wouldn't be, or, you know, if there was a rub in it, you wouldn't recce with that person anymore. But the big thing for me would be thinking back to Bjorn Waldegard. Bjorn was such a detail man. Bjorn would spend, in between Safari recce and the rally starting, there was always a period of a few days, Bjorn would come into the workshop and spend maybe 1 or 2 days working on the car, figuring out where he wanted everything, how the access was, practicing tire changes, practicing getting the winches off, if it was going to be a wet safari, where you'd put the straps, where you'd want to have the pull winch that can pull you out of a deep hole with a great big long wire and cable on it. all that sort of thing. He worked it out and he undid it all and redid it all, and messy things to do. But he would do all that and he would get into the car, understand, look at the car, ask for certain spares packs to be made, array his toolbox. Yeah, he was a detail man, but that would be the only comparison I could make. No other drivers went to that length.
Wow. It is incredible. And like you say, it's a great story. It's a story that that shows real humility, and hopefully we'll see we'll certainly see Formo at the finish, hopefully in Sweden. In terms of other news, obviously we were in Qatar for the first round of Middle East Championship, and another victory for Nasser Al Attiyah, the great Nasser Al Attiyah, who has now won, I think it's 452,000 rounds of the Middle East Championship. Along with the 62 titles that he's won or something. It's ridiculous. But
Has he now won more than Mohammed bin Salam?
I think so, yeah. Should we dive in and check? George, whatever you do, don't ask these questions.
Well, I wasn't asking the question, really. I was just posing it.
Where's Colin when we need him? Because Cole would have come up with the perfect answer for that. They're in the same ballpark or something like this.
They must be. Yeah.
Wasn't it nice that
Chris Meek and Mads Osberg went down there to see if they could beat him?
Yes.
And I presume that they were invited down to say, come down here and see it's for real. Two drivers that have both won WRC rallies, and they go down there and, I think they probably had a good fight before they fell foul of problems, but it looks like the problems were induced by overdriving, probably.
I've got to be honest and say I don't know about Osberg's. Obviously, we know about Meek's first day incident. In terms of rally victories, Nasser has had 77 victories, Mohammed bin Salam 60 victories, and in terms of titles, hang on a sec, right, talk amongst yourselves. Just fill us in, Luke, on what happened to Osberg. I'm going to put you on the spot now.
No, I do know that there is a report on the website, which I wrote, so if I didn't know, that would be a big problem. But Mads was leading, I think, just by under 10 seconds after the first day. He took the lead from Meek, who, as we know, you sort of saw from it, if somebody doesn't know, he had a bit of an oopsie, a rollover on the first hairpin of the fourth stage. It was a shame, really, wasn't it? It was kind of like Chris Meek's career in a nutshell. Fast, but just a mistake undid the good work. But he did at least recover to get a podium finish, which he didn't manage last year. So that was an improvement. But Mads was ahead of Nasser, and then had to clean the gravel clear on the second day, first on the road. And he was actually quicker on the first stage of the day as well. So he was giving him a proper race. And then I think he got... I've not seen any of the footage or anything, but he said he got lost. I'm only assuming with just the stage train, everything being so different to everything he's done before. He then got a puncture, which put him about 20-odd seconds behind. And then on the penultimate stage, I think he went over a jumper compression, which broke essentially the water pipe. And he had to retire with a water leak just before the final stage, which gave Nasser a winning margin of about 4.5 minutes. So it looked on paper like he absolutely walked it. And to be fair, I think Nasser was playing the tactical game. Obviously, he knows these rallies better than anyone. He's won this year's Dakar. He knows how to manage an event. But Mads and Chris, as you perhaps would expect, but they were there. But I always find this quite fascinating when you see drivers of their calibre come out of their comfort zone and essentially, and it sounds a bit detrimental to some of them, particularly Nasser, but race the locals, if you get what I'm saying with that. We had the same when we saw Craig Breen come back to Ireland for... What year was that? 2019 now? And even then...
The circuit.
Yeah. And he wasn't actually that far ahead either when he came back and did that. But I always love it when you see these WRC drivers come back to rally two cars and sort of race in places you wouldn't expect. I think it's fascinating.
Absolutely. And I think, what it does, it shows us, it demonstrates once again just what an absolute master of the Middle East Nasser Al Attiyah is. And of course we know that since 2003 he's only been beaten twice in the championship, which makes him a 17-time Middle East champion. Everybody knows that Mohammed bin Salam had 14 championships, so yes, Nasser is comfortably
he's Lobo and Ogier put together in terms of world titles in his domain.
Which is
nuts.
Yeah, he is. Which is pretty impressive.
He's a He is a canny old fox, and whilst he was undoubtedly being challenged by both Chris and Mads, he's the one that just did enough to win, and that's the key out there. You know, it's so easy to take a jump too fast, you know, go through a wadi. I've never been to Qatar to see the actual terrain, but it's so easy to make a mistake, to trip up at a hairpin. You know, rolling at a hairpin, that's not a horrendous driver error. That's just, you know, you've gone in, you've lit the car up, the wheels have spun up, and it should slip over the corner. And what's happened is he's just caught a rut that's maybe had a stone in it rather than dirt. You know, he's come into it. It's an excusable mistake for a driver.
Which,
if they need an excuse, I don't think they ever need an excuse. And Mads, he knocked a water pipe off on a jump. So yeah, NASA did a brilliant job.
But like you say, Luke, you know, in a microcosm, that is Chris Meek's career, isn't it? It's blinding pace, and then just a bit of misfortune. And there was somebody in Monty that I can't remember. When I was doing a bit of prep for this last night, I was desperately trying to think who it was. It was somebody really quite influential that had worked sort of 10 years ago in the sport. And I remember saying to them, who's the one? Who was your standout driver? And he said, Chris Meek. Always Chris Meek. In terms of speed, raw pace, always Chris Meek. There's never been anybody quicker. And it wasn't a Brit. It wasn't somebody from Northern Ireland. It was probably somebody from Citroen or something like that. And you just kind of forget that actually, you know, to go from A to B, you know, from when everything was working for Chris, he was just dazzlingly quick. But just had that tendency sometimes just to overcook it slightly, or just, as we said there, just to fall foul of the rock that was in the middle of the road.
Rallying's often described as a craft. Anybody can go quick. Anybody can go quick around 10 corners, but go quick around 100 corners. And rallying's a craft. And, you know, going fast on a single stage is meaningless in broad terms in rally. If you're not winning events, winning stages is nothing. Sorry, it is nothing in terms of a result. Okay, you're fast. Lots of drivers are fast, you know.
Yeah, but it's fast, George. There's 100 drivers that level, fast, though, isn't there?
Yeah, he is blindingly quick, and you've got to love Chris's passion and the way he approaches things. What a great spectacle! But actually, and he never at the top level, and I would say this far, because I don't think his career's necessarily over. In one respect, especially when you look at the longevity of Sebastian Loeb, but he almost just was missing that little ability to drop that pace back and hold his concentration. When he tried to do it, he very often made little mistakes, and that was an odd thing. It was it was unfathomable. I couldn't fathom it, because Chris, super intelligent guy, an engineer, you know, intelligent, clever, understanding, unbelievably quick, never quite put that super reliability aspect into it. So, you know,
well, he's testing with Skoda this year, and who knows, you know, talking to Mikhail Rabinek at the back end of last year, he said they would very, very, very happily have Chris in a car this year. So it's quite possible we could see him in WRC2. As you said, George, you know, the guy's got a lot of time left in the sport. Yeah. So let's wait and see. Sorry, Luke, I jumped in there very rudely.
No, it's okay. I don't like to. I'm not going to pick a fight, and I don't like to argue with people. But I do wonder, just against George's point, how, and I could be totally wrong with this, because you could argue that he had enough chances. But with Chris, I always felt it was, he almost had to overdrive a car every single time he went out in it. Oh, not necessarily, to be fair, in his last year with Toyota. I think there were a couple of mistakes. I remember the Paris stage, I think it was Portugal in particular, he was on the podium and he just clipped something on the inside. There was no need to push for anything. That was just game over. It did help Tanak, to be fair, find out Ogier's time and back off at the end, if I remember right.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe that was a team tactic all along. But with Chris, I think we can't forget the magic of 2016 and just how good he was that year in the Citroen. But you could argue there that was because there was no pressure on him. Because all he had to do was test the C3, come to rallies, he had a good position, he had everything in his hands to do it, and he could just do the job. But when it comes to a full year, he always felt like, to me, he sort of was too desperate sometimes to prove himself. And it probably stems from the fact that he spent longer than perhaps his talent deserved trying to get himself into the position. So he had the mini chance, which came, and then disappeared almost as quickly as it arrived, and then he got back into stitching, I think, a couple of years later. But even on his warm-up rallies there, his speed was mental, but he was putting it off the road and just showing that was his tactic. Most drivers would get in that car and think, right, we'll just get a finish. But Chris was like, nope, we're going to show everyone how quick I still can be. And it's a real big what-if for me. But as you mentioned, David, I would love it if we could see him back in WRC 2 or something like that, because we all know the quality of that field at the minute. So it would be no shame to see Chris in there at all. I think he is potentially going to struggle if he wants to get back into the main World Championship, just because there's not enough drives available. And he's probably had enough chances there that doesn't make him that appealing at over 40 years old for a manufacturer to take on. But he can still 100% do a job for somebody. So the Skoda fit seems really nice.
I think you're right. I mean, perhaps now we've talked about Chris for a disproportionate amount of time in the podcast, but he you know, Chris Meek is that kind of guy, isn't he? He pulls you into a conversation and you're there for a while. And I think you're dead right, Luke. In 16, he came to a part program in the championship and didn't have the pressure. And the way that he won, you know, both Portugal and Finland, was so calm, so completely collected. And I thought then that we turned a corner. And we came then, you know, with that C3, it was a shocking car. In Sweden, you know, in all the time I've worked in rallying, I don't think I've ever seen a driver quite
Who was the driver that developed that car?
Absolutely, I agree. But equally, there were significant budget restraints that we didn't see at the time that we've come to understand now, that it wasn't the same sort of development process that the other teams went through. But then you get to Mexico, that he won Mexico, forget everything that happened. And Corsica, he was absolutely bossing it, wasn't he? When was it some sort of oil pipe or something came off? And you think if he'd won Corsica, then he could have been probably close to the lead of the championship. Would it have made a difference? I don't know. But anyway, I do know that we probably should move on.
Definitely. More than disproportionate now.
Yes, absolutely. And the last bit of news really to talk about, we talked about it very briefly earlier, is Mexico has been off the championship. It was off the championship last year, of course, and this year, because in fact, all of the Americas is off the championship this year. And the reason for that is, obviously, Rally Mexico comes quite early in the season. It was supposed to be in March, late March, early April. And there were still some concerns over the logistics, with COVID-19 still hanging around. And basically the promoter wanted Mexico in, I believe, but it was quite a risk to send everything on the boat, to potentially have a flare-up again, or a new variant, and then everything would have to come home. So no Mexico for this year. So what the Mexicans are doing is what they do best, is they're improvising with the Rally of Nations Guanajuato, which is in 2009, they did this Rally of Nations idea. It's a brilliant idea. They bring two drivers from each country and then put country against country. In 2009, it was Chevy Ponce and I think Danny Sola who won for Spain. We don't know exactly who's coming. They haven't revealed the teams yet. We do know there's, I think, there's 15 countries coming.
What's the date, David?
April the 1st to the 3rd, which falls beautifully in the middle of our enormous yawning gap between Sweden and Croatia. And perfect. From what we can see, the it's the same stages, Chocolate, all of these brilliant, brilliant roads that we love in Mexico will be back this year.
David, this is really important news, because I want you to know, and I'm going to speak on behalf of Luke for this, that we as Scots, we can take the heat, and we know you can't, so we are prepared to go. Luke, I'm speaking on your behalf, Luke, we are prepared to go to Guanajuato on your behalf.
Yeah, that will be duly noted, because I was thinking about the date. We've moved back into April, so it will be even hotter, so there'll be even less requirement for my jumper, which concerns me deeply, obviously.
Yeah.
A great initiative. Fabulous to be back in Mexico, and hopefully, obviously, the overarching reason for this is that they want to be back and they want to demonstrate what they can do to come back to WRC next year. Big, huge investment from Guanajuato State.
Yeah.
and keeping...
If ever an event deserved to be in the World Championship, it is Rally Mexico. It is an amazing event, incredible organisers, incredible help from the state, from Mexico. Mm. And what an absolute platform to say, this is Mexico and aren't we fantastic? And you know what? They're right. It is brilliant.
Yeah, totally. And you know, sort of continual innovation with those people. When they came in all those years ago, you know, they were the first with the service park inside. And then they were the first with the first subterranean stage when the Guanajuato street stage went underground.
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And it's continued, you know, that 50 mile, 80K stage on a Sunday a few years ago.
Yeah. Chocolate.
It's
even the names of the stages. I mean, come on, chocolate stage. I mean,
exactly.
It's great.
You're never going to go far wrong with that, are you? And then also, I mean, one of my abiding memories was the Zacalo. Where in the center, right in the center of Mexico City, to see rally cars going through there was just phenomenal. And it's only when you talk to Patrick Subervell and Gilles Spitalier, the organizers, and you understand the effort that went in, that literally people were out there sort of scrubbing the rubber marks off the floor of this central piazza in the middle of Mexico City, because this is a real sort of historic part of the city. And they were allowed to go in there and use it, but they had to leave it exactly as they found it. And just the effort was quite phenomenal from them. So, yeah, great to see them back. And looking forward, of course, we've actually got a fairly busy weekend of motorsport coming up, Luke. We've got Extreme E back. And, of course, very importantly, we've got Snowdrift.
We do, yes. And George and I are
let's get into this Snowdrift thing, Luke. Crack on.
George and I are still looking for that plane ticket. It's not too late. Mm. So if anybody does have that going, then a continuation from last week. But yeah,
I'll come in your hand luggage as well. It would be a struggle to fit me in there, but definitely count me in for a bit of Snowdrift action as well.
Well, I'm sure that somebody can accommodate three tickets if we can find one or two or three. We'll keep begging, but yeah, it's one of those weekends. You're right, it's something we've had a couple weekends with not much on, then we've got two things to watch, which from a sort of website running news desk perspective was always a bit of a logistical challenge to have essentially two different teams rotating around different weekends. I'll be on
ARM. And time zones as well, isn't it?
And time zones, yeah. And I'm quite famous for not knowing my conversions very well from London time.
Likewise.
To America, so I'm not always the most reliable, but there we are. I probably shouldn't admit to that on a rally podcast, but there we go. But yeah, ARA, and you've actually, because it was on the thing, and I've forgotten to pull up the latest entry list, so while I'm going to casually talk over my typing so we don't hear it on the background of the podcast, but yeah, we sort of mentioned, if you missed last week's podcast, we did sort of talk about a couple of things about the event. Essentially, if you
Bonfire Rally.
Yes. Essentially, if you don't know too much about...
Take me there.
Essentially, if you don't know too much about the rally, it's the opening round of the American Rally Association Series on snow and ice, as the name would suggest, but without any studded tyres. It's not like Sweden, where the average speeds are just as high as they are anywhere else in the calendar. It's a bit of a... Put it this way, if you're Barry McKenna in his Ford Fiesta World Rally car, you're probably looking at where you can't hit things as opposed to where you can get the most time. It's one of those. Mm. But on that same point, where else would you find on the same entry list the last generation of a World Rally car and a Mazda RX-7? You wouldn't.
Oh, wow.
You wouldn't find it anywhere else other than America. It's just brilliant.
I suspect we will not hear that RX singing at 9,000 RPM or whatever it is they do. It's that incredible sound out of those rotary engines. It's a rally that, you know, the best driver will win that. It's such a leveler, and it can be quite a small car that wins it. You know, unlikely to be a world rally car, other than the fact it's probably the best drivers in those machines. But if there's somebody with real talent, if there's a budding Chris Meek crazy quick down the field in a fairly, you know, Group N type car, he could actually do phenomenally well here, because it's all about tractions. If you've got 400 horsepower, 400 times nothing is still nothing. And you've only got 200 horsepower, actually you're probably in a better position. Mm. You've got less to manage, so you'll actually go quicker. So great leveler. I would love to see a shock result.
You're spot on with that, actually, George, because it has happened over the years as well. And David, sorry, I'll let you make your point.
No. I was just going to say, just whiz us through the leading runners, if you could, if you have now located your entry list.
I have. So that's the beauty of waylaying the conversation. So I did mention McKenna and co-driver Leon Jordan. They are the 2020 champions. Had a bit of a difficult year last year, but it's looking like they're going to be mounting a full attack again around Barry's work commitments, which is great to see. In terms of actual top class entries, in terms of the open class cars, we are a little bit lighter. There is an announcement coming this week. Depending on when you listen to this podcast, you may well know, but due to the wonderful life of journalism and embargoes, I'm not permitted to say anything at this point as we record it, but there may be another car in the mix. But other than that, you've got driver, and I think a really interesting driver to look at this weekend is Kyle Tilley, winner of the Daytona 24 Hours this year. A very established racing driver, but taking rallying very seriously. If there is a feature on the website this week from the wonderful Mason Runkle with Kyle, and let's just say he's not got very many weekends off this year with what he's planning to do in a rally car. Assisted by Martin Brady in there. I think they're in a Fiesta Rally 2 with McKenna Motorsport. But he's meant to be doing rallies in the UK in Historic Escort. He's potentially doing a few WRC rallies. He's definitely doing Sweden. So he's not messing about. And it's not the easiest thing to go from racing around a track to driving on snow. So it'll be interesting to see how he fares, I think.
No, definitely.
It absolutely will. Well, if he's got talent, it can easily shine through on that snow rally. It's having the patience and the understanding. Racing drivers are generally very, very methodical. So I wish him good luck, actually.
Mm. And talking about racing drivers, there is obviously the racing element of Extreme E, which it will be fascinating to see back in Saudi Arabia in Neom this weekend. It was obviously quite a tricky event last year with all of the
dust.
Is it
the same course, David?
I don't know, to be perfectly honest, George. I would imagine...
It's moved location, I think, isn't it? I swear it was...
Has it?
All right.
Yeah. I think, well, you were there last year, David, so where did they dump you? In the desert?
Quite literally in the middle of nowhere. But it was, I mean, this is the thing. It was just extraordinary to be in the middle of the Arabian desert watching these things come, you know, up the steepest of steep dunes and down and dropping away. It was fantastic.
It was good to watch.
And, you know, they've had time to work on the cars, particularly the suspension was an issue. There's some electrical issues with the power steering and what have you, but I'm sure they will have sorted it. And they've got a great entry. And, you know, you look at the names, the likes of Christofferson and of course, the women as well. Jutta Kleinschmidt in there. And for me, Christina Gutierrez. Absolute heroes, these women. So it's great to see Emma Gilmore, McLaren in there for the first time. There's lots to keep us on our toes. But for me, last year, the ones that really deserved a huge amount more than they got was the Chip Ganassi team of Kyle LeDuc and Sarah Price. And yeah, I spoke to Sarah Price middle of last week. We're hoping to involve Sarah in our Women's Month at Dirtfish, which is all the way through March, and more news on that as it arrives. But Sarah was saying, you know, they were quietly confident coming into the championship. The pair of them have done so much off-road, so many Bajas and these kind of things. And one event that Sarah had just finished, excuse me, was the King of Hammers. So who knows anything about the King of Hammers? I knew nothing about it.
No, I've never heard of it, David.
I would encourage you both to go and Google it, and then your respect for people like Sarah Price will just go even further through the roof. So she came on the phone, and she apologised for... She said, and my voice isn't just like mine, actually. My voice isn't great at the minute, and it's because she'd been shouting in the car in this King of Hammers thing, and honestly, it's just nuts. But fantastically entertaining off-road racing. For me, if you want a tip for the championship, it's got to be Sarah Price and Kyle LeDuc at Ganassi. Hopefully they will have more fortune starting in Saudi Arabia this weekend. But yeah, great to see Extreme E back for another season. And now I think we are moving rapidly towards the point, George, where Luke and I will go make a cup of tea. And we will just listen to your six stories. You can try
that, David. But I'm going to deviate you away from that.
Ooh. bit of deviation.
To classic safari rally. All our Kenyan fans
crikey,
out there will be thinking, what on earth?
Yep,
what on earth is Dirtfish thinking about? Are
very,
we getting ignored?
Very sorry. Yep,
so,
no,
to all our Kenyan listeners, why are we not out there following that event, David? That's the first thing.
Why are we not? Okay. That's a very good
because
point.
Because it is an amazing rally.
It's a proper one, isn't it?
The classic rally. It's on a rest day today. It's on a rest day today. So we've had 4 days of action, rest day, and then we start again. I think they're staying down at Kilimanjaro Buffalo Lodge, or they're in the Amboseli Game Park there for a rest day, which has got to be very welcomed by everyone.
Yeah.
And it's 100-kilometer stages. And classic rally cars, Porsches, Escorts, Datsun 240Zs, Skodas, all sorts. Rover Vitesses, which were never really rallied in Safari, but they did have a good rally career in at least in Europe and or near Europe and UK. What a fantastic event, and it's going very well. It seems to be yielding the result. They've not had any terrible weather or anything, so it's going well. But anyway,
Patrick Sandell leading.
Yeah.
I was just going to say,
I do think, and I actually meant to mention this in the snowdrift section, because it's why Ken Block isn't there. It's because he's out in the safari. And I have to say, and I don't know if I should be, I don't think surprise is the fair word, but I'm very impressed with what he's, I think he's won about half the stages of the event already. He was leading after the first day. And given he's got practically no experience at all, competition-wise, in a rear-wheel drive car, let alone on a rally like this, I think it was deeply impressive what him and Alex Gelsomino have managed to do. And it is always this massive conundrum with Block, isn't it? People always criticise him and say, oh, he's only this driver, he needs 3 takes to do every single corner and stuff. But it's just, it's totally not fair. It really isn't. It's a lack of respect for what he does. And I think it's a really nice thing for him to come here and prove that he's on the pace of these guys that have done this rally so many times over.
Mm. And this rally is effectively blind. Look, there's no pace notes on it. They're driving on route notes.
Yeah.
If anybody's watched any videos, and they see the cars coming along and hitting a big bump and they go, well, why did they not slow down for that? A, you can't see it. It's very, very difficult to spot these things. And I've done Chase Car in Kenya back in 89, I think it was. And I wiped the arse of the car, to make no bones about it, twice. Broke the car twice, had to repair it twice to keep going. Just literally coming along, lovely big long straight, concentrating, absolutely clear. And then all of a sudden, 50 metres away, there's a wash away. And that wash away, the last wash away I hit, I nearly stopped for it. I just fell over the edge, 2 metres deep, effectively into a riverbed. And, you couldn't see the car from the road. If you walked back 50 metres, you couldn't see the car. And we had to try and get it out with broken steering. So, actually, we broke the steering on the way out of it, not on the way in. So,
No, but I think it's absolutely right. And next week, we will bring a more of a full report on the East African Safari Classic. It's something that we should have
done a
huge amount
Sweden,
more
then.
On. Yeah. I will confront you with this. You started 8 rounds of the World Rally Championship. You started your home round of the World Rally Championship just once. But you started one rally 6 times. Why? And maybe now, actually, George, looking at the time, we split this into two. And we'll have George's Swedish Memories Part 1. And so let's take us back to 1983.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. A fantastic event. It was a warm year. The snow was melted, or a lot of it was, but the rally went quite far north, so there was still a lot of ice. But the lake stage was cancelled in 1983 because it was too warm and too wet. We didn't make any pace notes. We were given the pace notes of Ari Vatanen for the rally.
How did that happen?
That was Peter Fubister had organised it. So Peter Fubister's brother, Peter Fubister was part of our car club in Scotland.
Yeah. And Peter Fubister, who was a former editor of Autosport and one of the finest gents ever to walk this world.
Yeah, the man that invented the Autosport show, I believe.
Yes, absolutely. Autosport Awards.
Autosport Awards, yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And a fabulous friend. No, he organised pace notes for us from... from Ari Vatanen, which we struggled to get. And then they were with the Opel team, and we spotted them out. We were loping around trying to get a hold of these notes and couldn't find anybody to give them to us. And finally, we spotted Fred Gallagher in the OK Motor Hotel where all the top teams were staying. And he was part of the Opel team, and he was there actually just helping Ian Grindrod write up all the pace notes. Well, I think it was Ian Grindrod, was it? No, Terry Harriman it would have been, form up all the pace notes, which was a huge job at that time. There was maybe 700-kilometre event, something like that at that point. And maybe 800, I can't quite remember. Anyway, we spotted Fred, and Fred organised the pace notes for us, so we got pace notes. But we had a homemade intercom. We didn't have any money. We had a homemade, my co-driver, Brian Woodward, who was an electronics engineer, he made our own intercom.
Wow.
That's fantastic. Out of old
telephones and stuff.
But, I mean, George,
we had no money. We had no money. But
before we go
fantastic.
Any further, though, George, you were in a Mini. Yes. And not, I mean, you'll obviously correct me if I'm wrong here, not a Cooper S, nothing, but regardless of whether it was a Cooper S and a flying Mini, it certainly wasn't an Ascona 400, yeah. Which, well, those notes were made for.
Yeah, but pace notes are pace notes, and Ari Vatanen's notes, which of course, those are the notes I learned to use, so I just used that system for the rest of my life. It's very similar to Juha Kankkonen's notes, which I used 1 year as well, because we couldn't make a recce later on. We struggled on a recce, and we used Juha's notes for that. Very similar. So my pace notes were the same as Ari's, because I learned on them. We made our own the second year.
So were they descriptive then?
Descriptive notes, yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So not sort of speed related. Not number, well, not gear related, sorry.
Not gear related, no. So even gear related is fairly straightforward, because you would correlate that visually and tactically to a speed for a corner. But the notes were fantastic and kept us on the road 100%. It was our first experience of notes. Although we knew the technique, because Fred, no, that's not sure. I'm not sure we must have had an example of notes before, and Brian and I had gone out and practiced at home making notes and reading them and understanding them to make sure we weren't going into the event just completely raw. But it was a club Mini car. Mm. It was a club Mini car. And what we did was we welded a club in front onto the front of it and put effectively a Group A 1275 GT engine in it. I think we just had to change the carburetor, basically. If anybody had really checked it, it probably wouldn't have been totally homologated correctly. But I remember at scrutineering, we got collared for two things. First of all, the scrutineer looked at our, you know, all the cars in Sweden were beautifully prepared, and our car was a bit of a dog to look at anyway. We never spent any money on making it look nice. We just tried to get nice brakes in it, yeah. and a decent gearbox and engine in it. We didn't have much money at all. But the idea of going there was just quite simply, you know, there is, you know, 400, 450 miles of stage driving. Even if you did the whole of the British Championship at that time, you probably wouldn't have done that. Well, you would have done more than that, because those events were about 180, 200 miles a pop. But so it was the equivalent of a lot of rallies. A Scottish Championship, it was double a Scottish Rally Championship at that time, probably. The organisers gave us free entry. We got reduced shipping. We got fuel vouchers for going.
Wow.
And free accommodation. So, and I love driving on snow. It was a massive leveller. And, I mean, obviously, you're going in a Mini. There's no pretext about what you've got, but I thought, right, great chance to learn. I was stupidly aspiring. I mean, I was a kid from Edinburgh, stupidly aspiring to be part of the World Championship or part of rally, with no hope at all. I had no money. I worked as a mechanic. I had two or three jobs at a time to try and pay for my rallying. No concept of the reality, and I refused to bow to any form of sensibleness. My co-driver indulged me, Brian Woodward. There was about maybe 12 of us went from the car club across to that rally, 8 spectators and 4 of us in the team. And we just had an absolute ball. The spectators had a great time following the top cars. They did see us a couple of times, I think. And we tootled around the back of this Swedish rally and had a great time. But at scrutineering, the scrutineer just looked at the car. I don't think he even opened the bonnet. He just looked at it and I don't like this car. really don't like it. Hakan Youngforce was his name, is his name. I hope he's still on the go. I've met him many times since. And he looked at the car, really don't like it. It was such a scruffy looking car, dirty. And, you know, we'd driven it from where we stayed, were quite a ways away from Karlstad. It would have been filthy by the time it got down to scrutineering. Everything else was immaculate going into the place. And in we popped, and he failed us because we had a Scottish flag on the side of the wings with our names. and he's kicking us out, but he said that's got to be a union flag. And he failed us at scrutineering. So quick as a flash, one of my service team had nipped round to the garage, got a touch-up tin of red paint from the accessory shelf in the big petrol station that the scrutineering was at the back of. It came back and we just painted a red cross on the white, and that became a Union Jack very quickly, you know. that was all we did. That's all we did. And that was us past scrutineering. It was a bizarre. And
incredibly, in that, just looking at some results, George, you finished just two places behind Louise Aitken Walker in an Escort XR3A, and you finished a good half hour ahead of a certain Denis Girardet co-driving Paul Gaudier in a Sunbeam Lotus. Yeah.
The funny thing on that was a couple of funny things about that. That was the first time I ever met Denis Girardet, a man that became a lifelong friend many years later. But we on the last night, probably the rally finished, I can't remember which, it was in the morning, sometime in the morning. The last night, you drove right through the night for the third night, I think it must have been second or third night. Double vision, we drove through. The triple vision was really hard, and we're having to get out and bury our faces in the snow. Brian was the same. We were both absolutely shattered. And eventually I slipped off the road just on a long right-hander over a crest. I just let the car slip a little bit wide. And we slipped off the road into a snowbank. And it was a massive drop on the other side of it. There were a couple of trees, and then it was a huge drop down to a river. As much as you could see it because it was dark, but we could see that it was a massive drop because we could look out and see the, you know, treetops. And Christ, we're just about down this massive drop. Anyway, we couldn't get out ourselves. And the next car along stopped and tried to help, and then the following car came along. That was Denis Girardet in the Lotus. I remember them being French. Yeah. And Denis can recall the event as well, pulling us out of the snow because we thought we were knackered. Oh. And we had many things like that. On that rally, if you exceeded a stage bogey and a stage target time. So I think they had a bogey time that would have been set so fast that nobody would have beaten it. Yeah. But the target time was set at like 60 kph. And the rule that year was, if you exceeded the target time for that stage, you were excluded. So that meant if you went off in a long stage for a few minutes, you would be okay. But if you went off in a short stage, you would be screwed.
Yeah.
And on the first night, we slipped off on a square corner, some slow corner. We just slipped off a little. Couldn't stop the car coming into it. Slipped off for a few seconds. Fortunately, we grabbed reverse and it nearly dug itself out, and then some spectators pushed us. And we got to the end of a, like, maybe just a 10-kilometre stage, literally 20 seconds from exclusion at the end of it. Brian was going frantic. You know, Brian was, we're in the stage reading the notes, and I said, no, forget the notes. Oh, are we going to make it in time? And Brian Ray says, shut up, drive, you know. That was it.
Maybe you didn't have sort of W stages, but what were the roads like? Were they, given that it was quite a warm one, was it really rutted? Or
it was that first night was all around Karlstad. It wasn't as bad as you would think. Some of it was, you know, you had to pop the mini. I mean, you can imagine those massive ruts, and you'll have seen them. They are absolutely like chariot tracks. Mm. Anybody that's ever been to Pompeii or Herculaneum, any old Roman town, you know, you see these chariot tracks. It was like that. But somehow we managed, and we were cracking on. I mean, I remember being in top gear for a long time. And there was, when we went right up the very north of the rally, one of the longest stages on the rally, there was a section with a massive wide ice road. It wasn't on a river, it was a road, And it went on for maybe 5 or 10 kilometres, a massive amount of time. We were just sitting between third and fourth gear. We're coming down to third gear on big, long corners just because the car didn't have enough power with the spiked tyres to keep it going as the corner tightened. So you'd be dropping frustratingly dropping down to third gear, which, you know, that would be top end of third gear. I had a long ratio in that gearbox I had, so top end of third gear would just be maybe about 70, and you pop it into fourth and it would only pull up to about 80, 85 on the ice. That was as fast as it would go. It felt dreadfully slow on that stuff. But still, we learned to drive on pace notes, and we learned to you know, keep pinned in on corners. And yeah, driving on the snow wasn't maybe just exactly the dream that we'd thought it might be, but it still was absolutely amazing. We had an absolute ball, and we went back the next year.
And just to say, you had, obviously that year the Swedish was won by Hannu Mikkola, but you had a great deal in common with the man who finished second, Stig Blomqvist, in that neither of you had a turbocharger. So that was the year that, because Audi realised it was onto a winner on snow with the only four-wheel drive car in the field, and they'd got Mikkola and obviously Michel Mouton in the factory A1s, so they put, I think it was because the Swedish importer had some influence here as well, they got Stig to drive the Audi 80 Quattro,
right.
Which was the new, it was a non-turbo, still five-cylinder, same engine, but without the turbo, it was probably 100 brake down. Mm.
At least.
And for I remember talking to Stig about this, and he was not best pleased to be left with what was then known as the poor man's Quattro. But still, I mean, he was less than a minute behind Mikkola at the finish, which was some achievement on that event, George.
I'm told by the spectators, our spectators that went there, that to see Stig, he didn't compare with anyone else on the event. There was nobody even in the same ballpark as the guy, because he was leaning on the four-wheel drive system to pull him out of everything. Can you imagine? He just wasn't braking for anything. He was only using the snowbanks and the angle of the car to slow it down. He just didn't lift for anything. Just utterly, utterly amazing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think Hannu was probably pushed quite hard at that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But unfortunately, what time has done this time is time has beaten us a little bit. So what we're going to do is, George, we will ask you to talk more next week, because obviously we move into Rally Sweden week next week. But we'll catch up with the other five stories from the other five Swedishes that you did. So I think that could well be a podcast in itself, which would be brilliant. So we'll talk about that more off air, George. But in the meantime, Luke, it's been absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much. And looking forward to reading all about ARA, Extreme E, and everything else brilliant that you'll be writing this week. And George, thank you very much. And of course, if you want to keep up to speed with what's going on, it is dirtfish.com. It is at Dirtfish Rally on the socials, and look at our YouTube channel as well. We've got some interesting videos going up. Particularly, have a look for Colin Clark's first visit to Dirtfish. That was a particular highlight.
I've seen it. That's fun, but I want to see him pretending to drive a car or trying to drive a car.
Stay tuned, George. Stay tuned, everybody.
I am desperate to see that.
Yes, yeah, as we all are. It's very entertaining, predictably. So thank you for listening, and same time next week. Thank you, boys, and see you then.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Luke.